Morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is James Lavode. I represent the steelworkers in this case. This is a case in which the NLRB issued a decision involving a contentious strike that occurred in 2001. The labor agreement in this case was set to expire on June 15th. The parties negotiated beginning on in mid-May, and the strike commenced a month later on June 16th. In Finch's preparation for the strike, before the negotiations began in mid-May, they made a decision that they would not operate the pulp mill operation part of their papermaking operation during the strike. Pulp is the raw material of which fine paper is made. They needed the pulp to make the paper. Their prior experience was that they could not use other people with a strike. They could not use replacements or salaried people to operate that pulp mill. Made a decision not to do so during the anticipated strike. So they had to purchase pulp on the outside market. They didn't know if the quality was going to be the level they needed. It was kind of a let's see how this works out situation. They were pleased to find by around August, as their plant manager testified, that they could produce their quality paper using this purchased pulp. And the price of the purchased pulp was at historic lows, so it was cheaper to utilize it than to operate its own pulp mill.
As I advised counsel in the last case, you may want to move past your factual argument and get to the legal issues.
I'm about to do so, Your Honor. Thank you. The legal issue on this question is, was there substantial evidence to support the board's finding that there was no decision made by this employer during the strike to continue operating with purchased pulp, in other words, to subcontract that operation beyond what was necessary to take care of the strike. Now, we say that the board's evidence in its finding that there was no such decision is no evidence at all. They premised it basically on a finding that, or on a bit of testimony by the CEO, that he didn't recall making such a decision in July. The complaint was not limited to July. The plant manager said by August they had concluded the quality was okay. Communications to its salaried employees by the end of July basically said, you're not going to go back to the pulp mill until it costs us more to purchase it than it does to run it ourselves. That's an indication that a decision had been made. The CEO testified that sometime after the beginning of the strike and before the September 14 letter to shareholders, a decision had been made to continue to use subcontracted pulp so long as the price remained low. The board ignored that evidence. And finally, they ignored evidence that the Finch lawyer submitted a position statement to the region in 2002 in which he stated that an entrepreneurial or business decision had been made some 7 months previously. And that would have taken, having written that letter in April 02, that reference would have been back to the July time period. Keeping in mind that the earlier May decision was, we're not going to operate the pulp mill at all during the strike. He writes to the region in April 02, a decision was made to not operate. It was a business and economic decision, and we have adhered to that decision. Well, what decision was that? It wasn't the original no operation of the pulp mill during the strike decision. It really had to be a decision made sometime during the summer. That's what the CEO admitted. That falls in line with what they learned about quality, and the board simply did not deal with this evidence. The cases of this court and other courts say where there is substantial, and we think this is substantial evidence, contrary to the board's finding on an issue, The board is obligated to consider and explain why that other evidence doesn't compel a different result. The board did none of that here. It based its decision on this I don't recall testimony, which is not evidence, is not even a denial. And it's speculation that if Finch really had made a decision, it would have tried to lock in long-term pulp purchase contracts.
Well, which that's is not nothing, then. I mean, the board did point.
Well, but this. Your Honor, they made a finding that Finch did not was concerned about continually monitoring quality of the pulp. So it stands to reason that that would be why they wouldn't enter into some long-term pulp contract. And even in November of,
alternatively, they hadn't made a decision to for it to be more than temporary. That's another way to read the evidence.
Perhaps the evidence could be read that way, but our point is that the board had an obligation to consider the contra evidence and to explain why the other evidence didn't compel a different result, and it just absolutely didn't do so. It just ignored the other evidence.
What do you do about the language of our decision in Land Air Delivery, which says that there has to be evidence, quote, to subcontract for, quote, an indefinite future period, not to terminate at the expiration of the strike, which I read to require an employer almost to have to say, we are going to continue to subcontract irrespective of the strike, or even after the strike ends, or the language not to terminate at the expiration of the strike to me means an employer has to say affirmatively that it is not going to terminate. We're not going to stop subcontracting when the strike ends.
Well, certainly that would be evidence that would fit into the land-air principle. But not all employers in a situation like this are going to say everything that they have decided. There are other factual bases to conclude that such a decision was made. We have the admission of the CEO. We have the quality finding, the low-cost finding. We have statements they made to shareholders and to salaried employees. And we have the fact that they continued to subcontract at the end of the strike, and they continued to purchase pulp on a so-called spot basis, no long-term contracts. So really, it was more of the same, and we think that there is substantial evidence that the board ignored and had to discuss in reaching its conclusions on this issue. A second issue in the case is the board's finding that the union waived its right to bargain when the strike ended over the continuing subcontracting of the pulp mill operation. And in that situation, the union sought information from the employer after the strike ended, which the union told the employer in correspondence, we wanted pulp contracts to see about getting our people back to work. The employer responded that it had made an entrepreneurial decision not to operate the pulp mill, and also misleadingly told the union that it had placed pulp contracts for the year 2002. This latter point was a finding of the board. Now, what we found out at trial was that that was not true, that the contracts were continued to be sought on a spot purchase basis. And in fact, when the union had asked for the information, the fact is that there were no contracts for the whole year. There was just this continuing evolving spot purchase approach to making contracts. We say that this amounted to a bargaining demand by the union, which the employer shut the door on immediately by misleading us and telling us that it was a management discretion issue. The board failed to consider whether that information request constituted a bargaining demand. There is plenty of case law to support the proposition, and the board just ignored it. The argument had been raised by the counsel for the general counsel before the board. Contrary to what board counsel and Finch have told the court, we are not foreclosed from raising this with you, because in fact it was raised by the general counsel before the board. They ignored that issue.
According from our circuit, the request for information is tantamount to a
request to bargain. There is a case called Dubuque Packing, in which the court enforced the board's finding that an information demand over a plant relocation amounted to a bargaining demand, cited in our briefs, Your Honor.
All right.
But I think from a realistic standpoint, aside from those that technical legal question, if you look at the situation that the union was in, we knew they weren't going to open the pulp mill. We tried to find out if their pulp contracts would preclude them from working with us to try to get our people back in. If they had long-term pulp contracts, that would be a factor that would make it pretty hard to say they should open up the pulp mill and bring our people back to work. But we got nowhere. They shut the door on it, and they misled us as to what the situation was on that. So I think that this was a factor the board should have taken into account. Its failure to consider it is error, and the court should reverse and send it back to the board to decide that. Another issue is their failure to allow us to submit evidence in response to Finch's affirmative defense that it had a legitimate and substantial business justification to not reinstate strikers, even as economic strikers. The way the complaint was framed in this case, there was a standalone allegation that it was discriminatory to fail to reinstate strikers at the end of the strike. There was a theory.
Well, your time is up. We've let you go over. But on that Dubuque Packing case, did this court discuss that question of request for information being equivalent to?
I don't believe the court discussed that issue,
really,
Your Honor.
Is not authority for that point at all, is it? There's no mention of that issue in Dubuque, is there?
It was decided by the board in the case below.
Judge Henderson asked you if there's any authority from this circuit, and there's not any in Dubuque, is there?
Well, in your brief on page 18, you say it explicitly held an information demand was sufficient to constitute a demand to bargain at note 36.
Well, if we stated it in that fashion, I thought that reference was to the board's decision in which, we did point out that it was a memorandum, a decision enforcing the board, is my recollection. So it may have been inartfully stated, Your Honor.
The board held that, but this court never passed on that question, did we?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. It's quite possible they didn't.
It's not really clear from the case that issue was even raised in the appellate, in the petition.
I can't say.
Okay. Thank you. Your time is up. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the cross petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Wallander here on behalf of Finch Prime, which is both a petitioner and intervener in this matter. As petitioner, Finch challenges the board's legal error in misapplying the Supreme Court's First National Maintenance decision to the separate decision made at the conclusion of the strike not to immediately redeploy its major capital asset and to reopen its temporarily.
How are you aggrieved by that?
We're aggrieved in three ways, Your Honor. First, we have a protective conditional cross appeal with respect to that issue. If you did not agree with the compelling evidence in this record with respect to waiver, you would have to reach that. Secondly, under the Electric Workers versus ICC case, we think this is an example of a case where the board reached out to decide a principal legal issue in a case.
How are you aggrieved about that?
This foundational labor law issue of what is a mandatory subject of bargaining affects us in a day-to-day basis in our interrelationship with these.
Other than as a bad precedent. How are you aggrieved by that?
Well, it is a decision which affects how we decide how we comport ourselves on a day-to-day basis in making these decisions.
Could any employer who's affected by that precedent come in here and have standing to raise this?
Well, we're the employer against whom this has been found as to what home mill which could recur.
How are you aggrieved by it?
We're aggrieved on the two bases of the conditional cross-appeal. We say the chilling effect.
Let's assume you win on the other issue. Do you have any independent aggrievement that allows you to bring this issue?
We believe under the IBEW versus ICC case that this principal issue in the case that is necessary to decide in order to come to the point of the question of waiver and the chilling effect on our day-to-day basis.
I thought if we decided waiver, we don't need to reach this.
If you decide the question of waiver, you don't have to reach it. But under the IBEW versus
ICC case, necessary,
the court could decide, because it's a principal issue, fully briefed and considered and decided by the board below. So it's the court's determination to reach it, and that's up to the court whether it chooses to reach it.
But again, if we decide on waiver, we don't need to reach it, correct?
We think under that you should but don't have to under the ICC case, Your Honor.
Is that IBE case cited in your brief?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's 862 Fed Second 330, Judge Edwards' decision in 1988.
Okay, where is it in your brief?
I'd have to refer to the table.
Give me the citation again, then, please.
862 Fed Second 330.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we think that the board misstated the law with respect to mandatory subjects by depositing an erroneous test which essentially says whenever legal labor costs are a factor, no matter how insignificant, that is a mandatory subject of bargaining. This court in Rock 10 recognized that there is a boundary issue for decisions that are primarily driven by labor costs in cases which they are not. And we say that the court should not allow the board to posit this wrong statement of the mandatory test for bargaining decisions, which it has put in this case, and sort of intended to immunize it from review by its waiver finding. This is not pure fiberboard subcontracting in this case. This is not the same people in the same jobs in the same mill supervised in the same places. This is a major decision as to whether or not to deploy a capital asset. That's a $25 million capital asset and all that goes with the need to run that asset. That, we say, and the fact that the decision here was driven by the externality of low-cost pulp, which is a decision over which the unions had no control, and amount of labor costs which the unions could not match. So on that basis, we say that there is an erroneous legal test here, and the board's decision on that legal test should not be allowed to stand. If I might also briefly comment upon counsel's statements with respect to his position here, counsel has misstated the April 2002 position statement of counsel in this matter, which appears at JA 1051. That statement referred to more than 9 months ago, and it refers back to the strike shutdown decision of the pulp mill in June of 2001, which appears in the very preceding paragraph.
What was that site again?
It's JA 1051. It's not 7 months ago. It's more than 9 months ago. In the preceding paragraph, the company talks that the company shut down the pulp mill on June 15th, 2001, the orderly shutdown of the pulp mill prior to the strike. In the context, it's clear that the references to the decision made in accordance with the strike operating plan to shut down the pulp mill to cope with the strike, and the spot purchases then are the temporary coping measures to deal with the strike. We also say that counsel has mischaracterized CEO Kuroda's testimony. It's a fact question in the totality of his testimony, but in his further testimony, he explains that all of his decisions were made in the context of the strike, and that he never made any decision other than these temporary coping measures with respect to the strike. The board found as fact that at the end of the strike, he separately considered and made a new decision with respect to whether or not to reopen the pulp mill, and at that time made his decision under the First National Maintenance Test based upon the compelling economic circumstances then prevailing. With respect to the question of waiver, the attempt now to argue that the January 23, 2002 information request was a request for a waiver. I mean, the best answer to that is the author of the letter, the information request, Mr. Scarsaletta, at JA 356 testified at no time was there a demand to bargain at the during the strike or at the conclusion of the strike with respect to resumption of the pulp mill. And in fact, there was no issue raised in the complaint that this was a demand to bargain, no exception by the GC, no exception by the union that would contend that this was a demand to bargain. And in fact, the charge was not even filed to about 6 months after the strike that there was a claim that there had been a failure to bargain. So we say on a substantial evidence basis, it's clear that the board properly could find waiver. Mr. Scarsoletta, the union president at page JA-356, so testified, and we think the board was within its power to sit there and accept that testimony. The other question that was raised in this this case was the claim that there was some independent theory of unlawful refusal to reinstate. At page JA-1338, the contention of the failure to reinstate strikers was withdrawn for the complaint, was not in this case. And actually, in this case, the general counsel.
Is anything about that in front of us?
I'm responding to what Mr. Lavote had simply said or had misstated, I believe. The allegation was withdrawn prior to the hearing in this case. And again, with respect to the general counsel's position in this case, it was that we had permanent replacements effective on October 15th. He committed to that, and the record at JA 56 to 57, and again at JA 397. So there was no issue with respect to the lawfulness of the permanent replacements. That was investigated by the board. They determined not to go forward and issue a complaint on that issue. There was no issue for us to meet on that subject.
Can I ask you that the dissenting board member in four or five pages, which is a fairly long dissent, isolates some of the evidence about the decision to buy on the open market and so forth. And she mentions in footnote 12 that in July of 2001, which was right when the strike was beginning, she says the respondent issued an internal memorandum explaining that it intended to mothball the pulp mill and reassign salaried employees working in that area until the cost to produce our own pulp is less than the price of the hardwood craft pulp.
That memo and all the memos issued during the strike were in the context of how the company was going to cope with the strike under its strike operating plan. That's what Mr. Kuroda, the CEO, testified to. That was the question of fact presented before the board.
But if they were saying we're going to mothball it and reassign the salaried employees, those employees were on strike at the time.
No. The employees that were reassigned were the salaried employees that otherwise would have been supervising that pulp mill.
Oh, okay.
They were reassigned, available in the mill, helping to cope with the strike too. Management employees, non-union employees.
Okay.
And that simply was part of the company's temporary measures.
Those of us from mill towns refer to company men as salaried people and union men as hourly paid, generally. That's a shorthand from...
Yes, Your Honor. So those, all of those...
I'm just explaining that to my colleague, counsel.
I couldn't have said it better. All of those company temporary measures then in the strike, with its pulp mill ready for reactivation, were basically measures to cope with this strike. We would say that the company acted lawfully, and the board certainly was within its prerogatives to find as fact that they were temporary strike coping measures.
Thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions,
thank you.
We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Joan Hoyt, counsel for the National Labor Relations Board. This case is before the court on two competing petitions. Both the company and the union petitioned for review of the board's decision against actions taken by both of them, taken or not taken by both of them during an economic strike. At this point, there are two issues because Your Honors might know that there was a third issue that we briefed, but it has been settled and removed from the case. So at this point, there are two issues before the court. The first issue is whether the board properly found, based on substantial evidence, that the company's unilateral subcontracting decision during the strike was a temporary lawful measure to keep its operations going until to get through the strike. The second issue is whether the board properly found that Finch being the company, did not violate the act by continuing its unilateral, by making a unilateral decision after the strike, a post-strike decision, because the union waived the right, never asked for bargaining, although it knew that that decision had been made. From the onset, I want to say here that this case turns on the evidence. And under Section 10E of the Act, if the board's decision is supported by, board's findings are supported by substantial evidence on the record as a whole, which it is the board's position that there is substantial evidence on the record as a whole supporting those findings, then the board's findings are conclusive. As to the first issue about whether the subcontracting during the strike was lawful, the parties were bargaining for a successor agreement in May of 2001, and the company realized or understood that there might be a strike and put into effect a contingency plan. The contingency plan provided for if a strike did occur, and the company had good reason to believe that a strike would occur, because in the 1999 negotiations for an agreement, there was a 19-day strike which the company had difficulty getting through, and it used salaried employees and some replacement workers, but yet it realized that it would not be able to manage the production of pulp, nor would it be able to find enough qualified people to run its pulp mill. So it put into place this contingency plan. And the union does not contend here that the contingency plan was unlawful. And it's on the basis of that contingency plan that the company, when the strike did in fact occur, an economic strike as a result of a lawful impasse in the collective bargaining agreement, in the collective bargaining negotiations, that the company put into effect its contingency plan. Now, the board found that at no time during the strike, and the strike lasted from June the 16th to November, I think the 16th of 2001, at no time during that period did the company change its mind about subcontracting. Yes, it is true that at the time of the subcontracting and the strike, because they occurred at the same time, at that time, the price of pulp was at historic low, and the company could get pulp for less than it could produce pulp. The fact that those market conditions played into the strike as it was occurring has nothing to do with the fact that the mill was closed. The mill was closed because of the contingency plan, and the company knew it could not find qualified people to operate the mill. The law provides for an employer, when thrown into an economic strike, to continue to operate its business. And by subcontracting, that was all the company was doing here. Accordingly, the board found that the subcontracting during the strike was a lawful temporary measure. On the second issue, the board found that the company did, in fact, at the end of the strike, make a second decision, and that decision was a mandatory subject of bargaining. Because the strike was over, the company had no reason to operate in an emergency mode, and therefore it was required to bargain over that decision. However, the board also found that the union was obligated to request bargaining and failed to do so. And because the union failed to do so, it waived the right to bargaining, and therefore the company did not violate the act, and so the board dismissed the complaint allegation associated with the post-strike bargaining.
You think the test the board applied to find it a mandatory subject of bargaining is consistent with our precedents?
Yes, Your Honor, that outside the subcontracting of unit employees' work, when those unit employees are represented by a union, outside of an economic strike posture, is subjected to mandatory. It's mandatory bargaining subject. I don't know. Did I answer your question in that respect? Yes. As I stated previously, the union did not take opportunity of the advantage to request a bargaining. It is true that the general counsel raised in its exception to the board in sort of general way, not in the exceptions, but in the brief in support of exception, in a general way, the general counsel raised the issue that the request for information was tantamount or akin to a request for bargaining. The board did not consider that because the evidence shows that the union's president, that's Local 18's president, also testified that the union never requested bargaining, and so the union did not see that request for information as a request for bargaining. That said, the general counsel raised it in passing in its brief in support of exceptions. The union had an opportunity after the board issued its decision, finding that it had waived its right to bargain, and the union had an opportunity to ask the board to reconsider that issue, and the union never did. On the union also now stands before the court and states or argues that there was joint bargaining, and the board found there was not. To be joint bargaining being the two unions, one representing the pulp mill employees and the other representing the paper mill employees. The negotiations for these contracts, there were seven unions represented. And one chief negotiator for all those unions, Mr. LeBron. But Mr. LeBron never told the company that he was representing all these unions, or there was joint bargaining. And there is precedent in this circuit stating that where joint bargaining becomes an issue, parties, the opposing party, cannot negotiate in ignorance. It must be told that one person is representing, or the unions are jointly bargaining, and that was never told here. But the board never reached that issue because the board also found it was not a part of the complaint. And so the company, the union inserts it here, but if the court wishes to rule on that, that issue must be sent back to the board because the board never decided that issue. The other issue raised by the union is that the board failed to consider its request about the replacement strikers and the company's failure to act or recall those replacement strikers. That issue also was not a part of the contract of the complaint, and therefore was not decided by the board and should not be addressed by the court. And if the court feels that that issue is relevant, that issue should also be remanded to the board. Let me just see if the court has no question. I think I have addressed the main issues that are before the court and the board.
Seeing none, then thank you, counsel.
Board rests on its brief.
What's the time situation for our petitioners? We We'll give each of them 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I want to make the point that on this question of the information demand as a bargaining demand, we can't expect union officers to be astute enough on matters of law to know to characterize in their testimony an information demand as a demand to bargain. That's why he didn't testify at the hearing that a specific bargaining demand was made.
Were they represented by counsel at that time?
They certainly were, Your Honor.
Okay. But move to that argument then.
Well, that would have been asking him for a legal conclusion. The fact is they tried to seek the information that would have led to bargaining. They told him they wanted it to try to get their people back in. The law doesn't require any specific phraseology for these things. It recognizes the realities of it. Dubuque may not be precedent in this circuit, but the board certainly has precedent on this issue that it failed to consider. The general counsel having raised this to the board, we weren't obligated to file a motion for reconsideration. It took them 3 years to decide the case in the first place. So we think that you have the capability to review that. As far as Finch counsel's letter in April 02 to the region, the position statement, I did misspeak and referred to it as saying some 7 months ago. I got stuck on the idea of July as the seventh month. He said 9 months previous.
We'll assume good faith, Joe.
All right. And as far as a stipulation that the replacements were, quote, lawfully made permanent, there is no such stipulation, contrary to counsel, in the record. Board counsel was asked in the course of the hearing, what was the status of the replacements? Were they permanent or temporary? And he said permanent. He wasn't asked whether there were any issues as to the legality of making them permanent, which would come up after the affirmative defense of Finch in response to the complaint. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Hear from the other petitioner.
Briefly, Your Honor, with respect to the waiver issue and the claim now not made in the complaint, not raised in an exception by the GC or the union, that the January 23rd information request was a request to bargain, that's simply not properly preserved. And if the fact question is, was it intended as a request to bargain, the best evidence is its author, Mr. Scarsoletta, testified at no time was there a request to bargain. With respect to the question of joint bargaining, I believe board counsel inadvertently misstated. Actually, that decision was made by the board. It was unanimous that there was no joint bargaining. At JA3 footnote 13, the majority says there's no joint bargaining. And at JA12, dissenting member Walsh concurs that there is no joint bargaining. The bottom line is this case is a question of substantial evidence. And there is no fact question raised that the union has succeeded in preserving or raising that overcomes the deferential standards of review. Counsel for the general counsel did commit that there were permanent replacements as of October 15th. That's at JA 57 and JA 397. And the union's claim with respect to the now claim that there is no issue about the reinstatement at the end of the complaint, there was an express withdrawal of the 8A3 charge at page JA 1338. There is no such contention as to which the company had to defend.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.
Thank you.
Recess.